This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our speaker this evening is Lisa Eiler, and I guess the programs did arrive, so it looks like you have your program. So you can read more detail about Lisa, but I know of her as somebody who has been passionately interested about ethics in addition to worrying about her science. So much so, she joined me in teaching research ethics to students at UCSD a couple of years ago and readily jumped at, I think she almost suggested this kind of a program for this evening, jumped at this opportunity to join us to talk about the topic you're going to hear about tonight. I won't go into any detail on that now, but we will be talking about it in more detail in a moment. So I would like you to join me in welcoming Lisa to give tonight's presentation.
Thanks, Mike, for inviting me, and thanks all of you for being here tonight. I hope we'll have a very engaging discussion after the talk. So I've been doing neuroimaging research for since I was a graduate student, actually, so since about 1994 when I started doing some of the very earliest functional MRI studies. So this is something that's near and dear to my heart. And when I got into neuroimaging, I was so excited about all the possibilities. And I remain excited today, but with some trepidation based on some of the challenges that you're going to hear about. There's many promises to the idea of neuroimaging. And as a clinical psychologist, I was really excited about how we could use neuroimaging to understand problems, the things that go wrong with the brain, and challenges, as well as normal behavior. So the promise of neuroimaging is really that it's supposed to be a window into the working of the brain of the living, behaving human. So prior to the advent of neuroimaging, we had to look at animal models, which were imperfect. We had to look at what happened when people had strokes or other damage to their brain and infer what that region might have been important for. Or we had to look at the brain after a person had died and infer from what their behavior was before they died and what you saw in the brain after death. So this was a great opportunity to look at the living, behaving human. It's also a technique that is relatively non-invasive and can be repeated. And so it allows us to look at things like how does the brain differ in people who have varying brain disorders, schizophrenia, autism, Alzheimer's disease. How does the brain change with development? How does it grow in childhood? How does it deteriorate in aging? Cognition, what kinds of things happen in the brain when we learn something, when we remember, when we keep things in mind, when we use language. Emotion, understanding what parts of the brain are involved in producing the kinds of emotional experiences that we have. And also psychological traits. And then most recently, people have started to look at things like love or truth-telling or ethical behavior. And so it's been really expanded to look at the full range of human behavior. And one of the other promises of fMRI was the idea that it was a very objective, concrete, valid, and reproducible technology that would allow us to make decisions about people, either decisions about their treatment or about their diagnosis or about their prognosis. But this is really what's come a bit into question over the last few years, and it's particularly starting in July of this past year. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today. But first, to set the stage for what the questions are, I want to just give you an example. So this is an example of a type of fMRI finding that you might see in a journal article or even a newspaper article. This is a paper that I published with my colleagues Karen Pierce and Eric Corshane at the Autism Center of Excellence. And the question we were asking is, how are the brains of children, infants and toddlers who have autism, different from children who are typically developing? And we did a study where they were actually sleeping in the MRI scanner. And while they were sleeping, we had headphones and we gave them bedtime stories. We told them bedtime stories, and then there would be some silence, and then they would hear bedtime stories again, and then silence. And we looked to see what areas of the brain reacted to those bedtime stories. And even though they were sleeping, you can see And that on the top row, the typical individuals had strong activation in areas of the brain that are responsible for processing speech and auditory stimuli. The kids with autism spectrum disorder had less of a response, particularly on the left side. And so when you compare the two, you see that there's this blob of red activation on the bottom that is more in the typical than in the autism group. Okay, so this is a typical sort of fMRI thing. There's a nice pretty picture of the brain. There's some pretty colors. There's some blobs of activation. And we use that to interpret what might be going wrong in the brain of kids who have autism. So how do we get to that kind of a picture? Well, those images were created with a technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging. And functional MRI uses a typical MRI machine. How many people have had an MRI scan for like a knee or anything like that? Okay, so a fair number of people. You know what it's like. You go back into this donut-shaped magnet. It makes a lot of noise. And in this case, we're imaging the brain. And the way that we are able to measure the activity of the brain is through something called the blood oxygenation level dependent signal, or the BOLD signal. And here's how it works. So when your brain is active in a particular region, more oxygen is delivered to that region than your brain actually can use up efficiently. So there's extra oxygen in the region where the neurons are working the hardest. Okay? The hemoglobin, which is the compound that carries oxygen, in the blood. Therefore, the hemoglobin that is in that area is more likely to have oxygen on it than not. It turns out that hemoglobin has iron in it. It's like a little iron filing, in fact. When it doesn't have oxygen, that iron is exposed. When it does have oxygen, the iron is kind of hidden inside. And so what that means that for the magnetic signal that we're trying to pick up is that in the area where the brain is working the hardest, the signal is a little bit better because there's a little bit more oxygenated hemoglobin than deoxygenated hemoglobin. So the iron filings are a little bit more hidden in the areas that are working hard than in the areas that are not working as hard. And so that's what we're looking for, is the difference in signal. It's a very small difference between the deoxygenated and oxygenated hemoglobin to give us a sense of where the brain is using, is pulling oxygen. Okay, so the images that we get from your typical brain activation paradigm look like the images on the left. Those are raw, bold images. So you can see they're kind of blurry. There's some places that are not well covered. It's hard to sort of tell what parts of the brain you're in. But eventually, we get to something like the image on the right, which is what I showed you before. So how do we get from these images that come off the scanner to the images on the right? So now you're going to get a crash course in fMRI data analysis. It's very complicated, but I'm going to try to keep it simple. But I need to tell you enough about that in order to explain what the challenge has been lately to fMRI results. So the data that we get off of the scanner is in the form of lots of different voxels. So you're probably familiar with the idea of pixels, like pixels on your TV screen or in your camera resolution. So voxels are just a three-dimensional pixel or volume element. And so in each voxel, we have some information about the BOLD signal. You can see there that you have the signal going up and down over time with the idea that perhaps this was people were asked to maybe tap their fingers and then stop tapping their fingers and then tap their fingers and stop tapping their fingers. And you can see the signal is fluctuating very slightly in that one particular voxel. But there are 30,000 voxels typically in an fMRI scan. And so there's a lot of those voxels. In each one of those voxels, we have to do a lot of pre-processing to get it to the point where we can analyze how related it is to the brain signal. There's some unwarping that has to be done. We like to correct for motion to try and put all of the different brain images across time into the same space. We often do some spatial blurring, so we get pretty high-resolution data, but then we blur it again because when we put people together in groups, we want to take into account the fact that not everybody's brain looks the same as everyone else. And then we usually put our data into a standard atlas space. So we put it into what's called the Tallarik and Tourneau atlas so that we know where we are when we're looking at activations. Once we've done all those pre-processing steps, now it's time to use a statistical technique called general linear modeling, which allows us to say how close is the brain signal to the stimulus signal that we presented. So we're trying to look at basically the correlation between the red bar on the top of that top middle one and the black activation levels, the bold response. And then that allows us to make a map in every single one of those voxels of how related the signal was to the stimulus we presented. So you can see there the individual p-values are color-coded so that hot ones are, you know, the most significant ones in the positive direction, and the cool colors are the most significant ones in the negative direction. So we have that map now for each individual person, and then oftentimes what we're interested in is whether there's differences between groups or how a group as a whole looks. And so you saw that we had the layer for the autism group, the layer for the typical group, and so we use group statistics, a group t-test, to put those maps together to find a group map. Okay, are you with me so far? Okay. So then we might have, say, and now I'm going to switch examples because I also work on schizophrenia, and this is an example from a study I did of verbal encoding in schizophrenia and healthy comparison groups. And so at this point, you might want to compare the activation in the two groups. So you have one map on the left of the healthy group and one map of the schizophrenia group. Now, if you look at this, you probably say, oh, those look pretty different. Right? There's a lot of red in the one on the left, there's a lot of blue in the one on the right. But the question is, are they really different? Like, how different are they? Is any of those differences reliable? Would we see those differences again if we did this experiment with a separate group of subjects? So we do a t-test, and that gives us another map of the differences between the two. And then this is the area where the challenge has come. Then the next thing we do is clustering. So now we have a value for the difference in every single voxel of the brain, but we want to boil it down to those areas that are really, we believe that they are different. And that's what we call clustering. So we try to find a cluster in which we're very confident that there really is a difference between groups. But the question is, how do we determine which activation differences between groups are reproducible? Which ones should we place our confidence in? So here's a little statistics for you. So you probably have heard of this idea of false positives. So in this case, false positive would be the situation where the group map shows a difference when we do our clustering, but the groups are actually not different in this region. So that's a false positive. There's also lots of different types of errors that can be made, including a false negative, but you could get a true positive and a true negative as well. And this is where the magical p-value of 0.05 comes. What we usually do in science in general, and in brain imaging in particular, is look for a rate of false positives. We want to keep our rate of false positives at less than 5% of the time. We accept the fact that sometimes we're going to make a mistake and we're going to find things that aren't true, and if you do the study again, we might not find that again. But we're only willing for that to be about 5% of the time. And so we're trying to figure out how can we do clustering or corrections to make sure that we're protecting this 0.05 of false positives and that our results are likely to be true, but that there might be some false positive about 5% of the time. So how do we do that? Now, I already told you that we're doing these statistical analyses at 30,000 different voxels. That's a lot of statistical tests. And if anybody knows anything about statistical tests, you're supposed to really correct for each test that you do so that you get a p-value across all of those tests that's realistic. So one way that people sometimes correct is they'll take the p-value and they'll divide it by the number of tests and say that you have to have a significance level in each of those voxels of, in this case, if we took 0.05 and divided by 30,000, a significance level of 0.000017. Okay? So that would be pretty stringent. It might be very difficult for us to find a difference between groups that was that strong in magnitude in any given voxel. So the alternative that the fMRI community had come to is to suggest that perhaps no one isolated voxel is likely to be believable. But what if there are a lot of voxels all together in the same spatial region, because the brain kind of works in little modules that are near to one another? So if we had a lot of voxels that were all significant, all right next to each other, maybe that would be more believable. So the strategy is to try to estimate how likely a cluster of a given size would be where every voxel in that cluster has a p-value of less than, say, 0.01. and you only report in your pretty pictures those clusters that have all the voxels at a certain level of p-value and that they all together are big enough so that it would happen only less than 5% of the time by chance alone. So this is how we operated for about the last 15 or 20 years. And this seemed reasonable. It was taken from, there was lots of different ways to figure out this cluster combination, threshold combination, but different software packages did it slightly differently, but it all was basically the same idea, is that we could figure out and make some assumptions and could figure out how big the clusters needed to be to happen only less than 5% of the time. So in July, we started seeing things like this on the internet. Maybe some of you saw something like this on the internet. The last 15 years of fMRI research might be totally useless due to the recent discovery of an fMRI bug. About 40,000 papers on brain research may now be invalid. So I actually didn't see this. What happened to me in July is I got an email from my Uncle Todd, I got an email from my Uncle Bob, and I got an email from Mike Kalichman. And all of them said, hey, have you seen this? I know you do this kind of research. What does it mean? Is this a problem? Are all your studies invalid? So I knew that there was something up, and so I had to go and look and try to figure out what is it that was actually causing this reaction across the internet. And what it was this paper by Eklund, Nichols, and Knutson, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, called Cluster Failure, Why fMRI Inferences for Spatial Extent Have Inflated False Positive Rates. So what did Eklund, Nichols, and Knutson do that shook things up so much? Well, what they did is they took advantage of the fact that these days there's a lot of resting state data. So that means data where fMRI studies where people went into the scanner and they didn't present any kind of stimuli at all. They just laid in there for 5 to 10 minutes with their eyes open looking at a cross, but they weren't asked to do any kind of test at all. And these data have been shared on public repositories. So they had access to hundreds of these resting state data. And so what they did is they took these resting state scans and they analyzed them pretending that a task had been performed. They said, what kind of results would we get if we said, well, instead of resting, they were actually tapping their fingers for 30 seconds and then not tapping their fingers for 30 seconds and then tapping their fingers for 30 seconds and then not tapping their fingers. So they applied a stimulus pattern to the data to see if they would get anything, with the idea that anything that they saw would be a false positive. Some of you may have heard of a study where somebody put a fish in the MRI scanner and found activation, clusters of activation. This was part of this whole effort to try and understand false positives. Okay, so a dead fish, I should say. I'm sure a live fish would have some fMRI activation. So they did this analysis. They repeated the analyses 1,000 times with random groups of 20 subjects each, and they counted how many times there was one or more significant cluster as determined by a variety of different software programs out of the 1,000 different times that they randomly changed who was in the groups. Okay, and remember, the people were not doing any kind of test that would match what they applied as their stimulus paradigm. So here's an example of some of the results that they found. So to read this graph, on the y-axis is the family-wise error rate, which is the false positive rate, and they have a big black line at 5%. That's where you would want things to be, is somewhere under or at that line. And on the x-axis are many different, very standardly used fMRI software packages, including SPM, FSL, and AFNI, which is the 3D T-Test and 3D MEMA. And what I think is pretty obvious is that in almost all, and the different bars are just different types of stimulus paradigms that they mimicked. And there's different ways of doing fMRI where you can put things in blocks or you can look at different events. So those are just different ways of mimicking activation when in all cases there was no stimulus. And you can see that for this data set, they found false positive rates of 20 to 30%. Okay? So it's supposed to be down at 5%, but it was way up at 20 to 30%. The only exception is the one on the end that says PERM, and that stands for permutation. And so a permutation test is where you kind of randomly take your data and you shift it all around and you flip the signs or do something else to shift it all around and see within your data set how often does something happen by chance, which is not a technique that had traditionally been used by these software packages. They were making some assumptions and using some theories to figure out how big the clusters should be. They were also using some simulated data. But the only one that really worked was if you use your own data and do a lot of different permutations of that data to see how often in your own data does these kinds of clusters come out. Now, you may remember that they said that there was a bug in the software. So, in fact, it wasn't mainly a bug. There was a problem with the assumptions that were made in the software that was shared by all software packages. But there actually was also a bug in AFNI, which was one of the software packages. And it turns out these are data from the AFNI creators. They fixed the bug. They acknowledged that there was a bug. They fixed it, and it really didn't actually have any effect. It was just as bad after. It was like a little bit less bad after they fixed it, but it was still, you're still seeing 20 to 30% false positives with that. So the bug, even though that was what was advertised, that there was this bug that had been there for 15 years, that actually really wasn't the problem. The problem was the assumptions that we made about the shape of the spatial correlations in the noise, not to get too technical. So the bottom lines from this challenge are that actually the study found that the individual voxel p-values were actually accurate. So each individual p-value that was calculated had been done correctly. The problem was at this clustering level. The cluster extents that came out of these software packages were generally too small. It should have needed more voxels altogether in order to have that probability of 5%. It turns out that this problem is actually not so bad if you make each voxel have to be very significant. So if you choose a lower voxel p-value like 0.001 instead of 0.01, then you don't really have to worry about this as much. Then the clustering programs work okay. It's only when you're trying to go for something like 0.01. And permutation tests are the best way to fix this. So the question is, does this mean that 15 years of fMRI research is invalidated? Well, the authors of the paper originally said that 40,000 studies might be wrong, which is where that blurb came from. But then they corrected that and they took out that number. It really only applies to studies that used this kind of whole brain clustering, which is a great deal of studies, but not all fMRI studies use clustering. A lot of studies look in particular spots and try to see how much activation is there in a particular spot. They aren't trying to cluster across the whole brain. And a lot of studies may have used a more conservative p-value, 0.001 instead of 0.01. The other thing that I think is important to point out is that we have had 15 years of fMRI research, and there's a lot of consistency from study to study, even though they're not doing exactly the same thing, and they all had this problem. If there was really all false positives, we wouldn't see consistent results show up in reviews, meta-analyses, etc. So it suggests that it really doesn't invalidate 15 years of fMRI research. Still, there are some problems and challenges. Some published studies, up to 20%, actually don't even do any correction for this multiple testing problem. And I found that amazing because that just seems like that's an obvious thing. You have to do some kind of correction. But a lot of studies were not doing that and probably still aren't, although now there's heightened awareness, so it may not go through anymore. And if we're trying to use fMRI to say things about individual subjects, there hasn't been a lot of work on the test-retest reliability. So if you put somebody in the scanner and do the exact same test one day and then a month later, are you going to get the same clusters of activation in that person's brain? We don't know that much about that. We're just starting to learn about that. And very few studies examine the sensitivity and specificity of findings. If you're trying to use fMRI as a test or as a detector of some sort, it's very important to look at it, not whether there are group differences, but whether something that you see in an individual predicts something about their outcome. And as was emphasized in this paper, it's really necessary for us to do more data sharing because, for example, when you go to the lab and you get your blood drawn, right, and you get your test results back, it gives your value and then it says what the normal range is, right? We don't have norms for fMRI activation. But if we were going to use this in a clinical setting, that would be important to say, okay, your activation in the amygdala was, you know, at this level, and this is within or outside of the range for other people of your age and gender, for example. So there's a lot that we still need to do. And then there's some general challenges with the use of fMRI. It's a very relative measure dependent on baseline. As I mentioned, it has to do with blood oxygenation, not actually neural activity. And because of that, you can't get fine-grained timing on the order of milliseconds. And then you may have noticed that there were some holes in the images. There are certain places that just are not imaged very well by fMRI, which makes it difficult for us to know what those areas of the brain are doing and whether or not they're important, but we just can't measure it. So I think I'm going to stop there. Thank you for your attention.
So thank you, Lisa. There is a general principle occurs to me that comes out of this, especially for those of you who aren't in science, that I think is worth underlining before we continue, and that's that much of published science, experimental science, is based on this standard Lisa mentioned of probability less than 0.05, which means you get to publish when you can show there is less than a 1 in 20 chance that you're wrong. It's not a very big standard to meet when you think about it, but that's the standard we have in science. That standard means that when you publish something, it doesn't mean it's true. It means that you have reason to believe that you aren't wrong. And that's not as rigorous as a lot of people think when they see a headline that says such and such drug cures cancer or whatever else. It's probabilistic. And because it's probabilistic, we have the risks Lisa mentioned of false positives and false negatives, which leads me to what we're going to be doing next. So during the brief break that will follow, we're going to ask you to divide into some small groups, and each group will take responsibility for one of four scenarios we will be passing out. And we want to get your thoughts on what should we do. This is not just for your fun, but for education of all of us to think about what are the options for dealing with science like this that is at the cutting edge, very exciting, but we don't yet know what it really means entirely. When will it be good enough? Is it good enough already? What we're going to do is ask each group to come up to the representative of each group to come up to the microphone and tell us your thoughts. And what I'm going to do is I'll read the scenario first so that we're all on the same page, so we know what this particular scenario is, and then we'll hear from the representative of that group. So we'll start with scenario one. Scenario one stated the following. fMRI researchers publish a series of studies showing that based on resting patterns of brain activity, they can read your emotions. The police decide to use fMRI to screen applicants and eliminate those who show negative emotions towards pictures of certain types of people. So for those of you who weren't part of that discussion, what this means is researchers say that we have decided that certain regions of the brain suggest that you have an emotional response to something you're seeing. And the police have decided that they are now going to use that to screen out applicants for the police force.
So we had a hard time with that at this point. I think that at first we were kind of thinking like, well, this is going right into someone's brain. And so we kind of came up with maybe. I hope you can let us, you know. So it would be nice to be able to have police officers that didn't have prejudices. But we also were wondering the things that we should know is how reliable is it? Can people control their own emotions? I feel like they can. I feel like people can cheat lie detector tests. They can psych out their own emotions. And I'm kind of wondering if something like that can happen here. So if we did decide to do it, though, for Part C, it should be an outside group that is evaluating the applicants using the fMRI process, and they shouldn't be law enforcement teachers or part of law enforcement at all. So that way it's not like law enforcement instructors are choosing favorite students or unfavorite students or whatever. And also there should be a way to have them be dismissed that doesn't like violate their privacy, because sometimes it could be wrong and you don't want to ruin someone's reputation like forever. So maybe they can just say they didn't pass the physical or whatever, but I know that's also kind of sketchy, like making something up. But anyways, that's kind of our thoughts.
Just very quickly before I ask Lisa her thoughts on this then, it sounds like your group said maybe, and what you're worried about is the risk of saying that somebody did have an emotional response that really doesn't, so that's a false positive, or vice versa, that they didn't have an emotional response because they faked it, as you said, or something else, and so you got a false negative. So in that case, did you guys come up with any sort of, how sure do you have to be? Is it 1 out of 20 error? Is that good enough?
So we didn't actually come up with it ourselves, but if it's overwhelmingly it works most of the time, then I think then we can justify doing it.
Okay, so 99 out of 100?
90, even 95, I think, out of 100 would be
okay,
like 90, more than
95
100.
Okay.
Yeah, so
right, 5%. Okay.
Because, I mean, nothing's going to work.
Okay. You know, do you have any thoughts on this scenario? And
yeah, well, I think it's a good point to bring up the idea of kind of can you control your emotions? So the premise here was the idea that it could detect sort of unconscious bias or unconscious emotions, and this was the first part of the scenario is based on a real study. That is, there have been researchers who've developed. In fact, this just came into my inbox yesterday. It was perfect timing. Came into my inbox that there was a study where they showed that they could read your emotions based on the pattern of your brain activation when you're just lying there doing nothing. So presumably, but of course, I think I agree with you that what's needed is some more studies to show, okay, what if you were purposely trying to fake like a certain emotion or to get rid of a certain emotion, and how would that influence the brain patterns? How easy is it to fool this test, so to speak? So I think that's an important factor.
Okay, thanks. So let's go on to scenario 2, and I think that was back here. What I'll do is I will read the scenario so everybody else is up to date. So this one says, brain activation patterns differ between those who are purposely telling the truth versus those who are told to tell a lie. A defense attorney argues that the results of an fMRI should be used as evidence in a trial, presumably to tell if somebody is lying in the trial. So what did you guys think?
In this scenario, if it was this was proven true and it was reliable, then we believe there's no real harm in doing it if there is enough reasonable doubt to the person's testimony. If they could be lying, then we see no reason why we shouldn't test this. As if they aren't, then we should get nothing from it. The trial would continue on as if normal. To change our answers from yes to no, we just wanted to know about how reliable is this information if it was true. And for the last one, who should have a role, we never really came to a conclusion on that. We didn't have enough time.
Okay. And just before you leave, just to as a reality check, so did you consider the design of how they figured this out? Because the design says that the person who they're testing in order to test their system is purposely telling a lie or purposely telling the truth, which might be considered to be different than somebody who is telling a lie because they don't want to get caught. So did you consider the difference between those two situations?
We didn't consider the difference between those two, but we took this for face value, saying people who are told to tell a lie have different brain activity than those who are purposely telling the truth.
Yep.
So even those who may be telling a lie that they weren't told to, we assume that they would have no different brain activity.
Okay. So what do you think, Lisa?
Yeah, I think the devil is definitely in the details with this, because I do think that it's a little bit different, sort of your reasons for deceiving, as well as, and I think I heard you guys say this too, that sometimes you could be saying something that's not truthful, but you believe it to be true. You know, so I think that's an interesting thing. So that the question is, will the brain patterns be the same if you are, you know, deceiving because you don't want to be caught, if you're deceiving because somebody told you to pretend that you're that you don't know to say the wrong answer, or if you're saying the wrong answer because you believe that answer to be true. And so I think all of those things are very subtle and very difficult to detect differences. But that's where I think more research would be needed in this area.
So you have, right now we use lie detector tests. So that's brain activity. So why something's making your heart go faster, whatever they do.
Right. Well, the folks who are, there are people who are interested in using fMRI as a lie detector test, and there's marketing for that. And those folks argue that this is better than a lie detector test. So part of their marketing strategy is to say, okay, well, you may not believe that this is perfect, but it's definitely better than a lie detector test, because there's all kinds of reasons why you might get false positives with a lie detector test, and that this adds to that. Another interesting thing, when I met with one of the people locally that's trying to develop this technology, is that a lot of times lie detector tests are actually not used for the purposes of being admissible for court, but are used by law enforcement to force people to confess. So basically, if they use the lie detector test and then they tell them that they failed, then they will actually confess. And in fact, he told me a story that a police person had actually told a gullible person that he could put his hand on this machine and it would tell if he was lying or not. And he took a Xerox copy of his hand, and then the kid confessed because he told him that he had failed. So the other idea would be that you could use this in that way and it wouldn't matter whether it was accurate or not.
Two things come to mind. One is that I wonder whether that would be admissible in court, or that might be challenged. And the second is, if this is a strategy being used by our police, then I suspect they wouldn't want it advertised that this is a strategy that they use. So
I'm guessing those people aren't watching this.
Okay, so maybe we should move on to, there's a second group that had the same scenario.
So we actually came to almost the opposite conclusion of the first group. We said that generally we would say no, mostly for the reasons that you mentioned. The unreliability of eyewitness testimony means that some people might genuinely believe that they were telling the truth and at the same time actually be inadvertently lying. And the scenario is really just focusing on purposely telling the truth versus purposely lying. We were also wondering how this would apply to pathological liars, or not even pathological liars, but people who are just generally very good at lying. They have a lower physiological response when they're lying, and they're not as susceptible to the traditional signs of lying as others. And we also thought that we were worried that the kind of lower level of accuracy in current technology, and in addition, the size of the control group, might also be factors in why we would say no. So if we did want to change our answer to the yes, we would want to have a larger control group for starters. We would want to make sure that there was reliability in who was telling the truth versus telling a lie. And we would also want to sort of engage a less controlled setting almost, which I know is difficult in scientific studies, but we would want to make sure that we could see what would happen in the scenarios we mentioned with pathological liars, people who believe that they are telling the truth but are lying, and see how brain activity works in there. And we ultimately, for the third question, we came to the conclusion that we would have to have both a scientific consensus and an admissibility, the judiciary's belief that this would be an admissible piece of evidence in court in order to decide if and when we could do this, and only then would it be a reliable piece of evidence.
Thank you. Do you have any thoughts on?
Yeah, no, I think that's all really important, and it's an interesting question too about sort of scientific consensus. So, how do we build scientific consensus? As Mike said, one way is to just have a buildup of studies that all show the same thing, p less than 0.05, and then people tend to do these reviews, or what's often called a meta-analysis, where they take the results of studies and they put it together and they say how likely it is, but it's interesting because, you know, these meta-analyses are sometimes challenging because the results and the methods can be very different from one study to the next. And so you don't know if you're trying to combine apples and oranges. And there's often a lot of heterogeneity in the results. And so, again, it's an interesting question, sort of, when do we have scientific consensus? How many studies is enough? You know, if you ask the media, one study is enough, right? Because they're ready to just put it on the front page as soon as there's one interesting study. Most scientists would say one study is not enough, but I think there would be a big, if we asked a group of scientists, I think there would be a lot of disagreement about how many studies is enough.
Yeah, well, I think one of the issues that comes to mind is the importance for any of these things is to at the same time recognize how horrendously difficult this is and still try and come up with the best possible answers. The meta-analyses is a good example of this. I'll go a step further and point out that meta-analyses in principle sound very good to look at all of the published work and say, what does it say? Is it consistent? But it could be consistent not because different people are independently finding the right answer, but it could be because they are so closely allied with one another in choosing their models, choosing their approaches, choosing their descriptions, deciding what gets published, that they end up clustering to give you the same answer. And, you know, in this current political season, you could imagine if you only listened to certain kinds of radio, you would have unremittingly one story and assume that's the only story out there. Conversely, if you listen to other radio stations, you would get another completely consistent story. Meta-analysis would look great, but one of them, maybe both of them, is probably wrong. And by clustering, you may, in fact, see something that looks positive when it isn't. So even meta-analysis can have problems.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we'll take one quick question, and I'll repeat it. There are many different ways in which individuals vary. So not just what is a sufficient sample size, but what is a sufficiently representative sample in order to make a comparison, I think, is what you're asking.
Yeah, and I think that is really interesting, and it gets to different kinds of designs. So most of the fMRI studies that are out there to date have been comparing group A to group B, and I showed you a lot of examples of that, autism versus typical, schizophrenia versus healthy comparison, and the techniques and the statistical approaches that we use are designed for that. And then we have variability within each group, but we can see in general that one group is higher than the other in some region. But when we come to asking the questions of whether for an individual person is a test good or not, then we get into a different realm of talking about the sensitivity, the specificity. We get into this idea of having norms for, you know, what factors are important. You know, how do you compare to somebody your same age, your same gender, your same education, your same background? And again, how much variability is there around each person's average performance and whether that variability itself may be an interesting thing. And some people may be more variable than other people. And I think when we're getting into this idea of personalized medicine, personalized testing, the types of scientific approaches that we take have to be very specific. So I actually, outside of the realm of fMRI, but I heard one of our local experts, Nick Shork, who is interested in personalized medicine, talk about this, exactly what you were saying, this idea that what's important is what's your norm. And so it's not so much when you fall, like say if somebody was getting a clinical test, and as soon as you wanted to, typically you would wait until you fell below the average for other people your age for that test. But if this person was very consistent and they were always having the same value, and then if they just dipped a little, even if they don't dip all the way to below the norm, that's probably a bad sign because they've been consistently having this value. And so when we're talking about these kinds of individual tests, we have to look at different metrics.
So again, it's not simple. We should move on to scenario 3, which I think was somewhere around in here. So the scenario is, brain response differs on average between people who respond to a certain antidepressant treatment and those who do not. A major academic center begins pre-screening patients with fMRI to determine whether or not to recommend this treatment. So should we use fMRI to figure out which drug to use?
Well, we enjoyed a vigorous discussion from a very contemplative group, and what we came up with was we need a lot more information. So the information, and it was actually a fantastic discussion. First, we'd want to know how the brains, generally speaking, people who have been diagnosed with depression versus not diagnosed with depression differ, and what is that level of difference, generally speaking, and then what we read into this, and hopefully that's correct, is that within that diagnosed with depression group, it sounds like there are subgroups of differences in brain responses, and some of those people might be responders versus not responders, and how reliably can we really detect those responses. So we touched briefly on the what does this mean from a clinical point of view, from a you might be one of these people or not, you might get invited into the study or not, what would that mean? But so we didn't feel like we had enough information to answer the first question. But in terms of a role and responsibility, we talked about how it's interesting. We almost would want to know how this drug would be used in order to say who should be involved in deciding, because currently, if you're giving a drug, you don't necessarily demand that you have an MRI before you're giving it. And is that going to be part of the prescription path or not? So we had a lot of big question marks, but it was a fantastic discussion.
Good. Well, we only had one group with scenario 3, so I don't know whether Lisa wants to add any nuance to this and maybe fill in some details and say, here's what you could have answered if you knew this.
No, I mean, I think those are all really important questions. I think one of the issues, which we've already touched on, is that in the scenario as it was presented, it was just that there was a group of people that responded and a group that didn't respond, and they had, on average, some brain activation differences. But does that really mean that if any person comes in, you know, and their brain activation looks more like the responders, that they themselves will be a responder? So again, it gets to needing to test the sensitivity and specificity. But there was a recent study that looked at response of people who have social anxiety to cognitive behavioral therapy for social anxiety. And one of the ways that people have decided whether somebody needs cognitive behavioral therapy for social anxiety is how severe is their social anxiety. So that was kind of the baseline, is how, like, if you have more severe social anxiety, do you respond better to CBT than somebody that doesn't? And that had a certain accuracy, which I believe was around like 60% accuracy of predicting who was going to get better versus who wasn't. But then they did brain imaging at rest with fMRI and also some DTI, which is a structural method. And when they added all that information in, they were actually able to predict, you know, with something like 85% accuracy whether you were going to respond to social anxiety treatment for social anxiety or not. And it significantly improved the prediction if you added the brain imaging measures over the just knowing the person's severity. So that was an example of something where they're trying to move towards this idea that you could really say, okay, you would be somebody that would respond. But I think you also bring up the question of how exactly does this play out? So if you get the answer that you're not going to respond, then what do you get? Like, do you get an alternative treatment, or do they just say, I'm sorry, we can't help you? You know, so obviously the important thing would be to then figure out those non-responders, what would work for them. And what would be great is if we could have somebody do brain scan and say, you're the type that would respond to CBT. You would do better with this medication. You would do better with this kind of spiritual counseling and whatever, so that we could sort people into the thing that's going to work best for them. But I think we're pretty far away from that.
That leads directly to a question that just occurred to me that could be relevant to all of this, not just for choice of drug treatment for various kinds of psychiatric conditions, but for anything. Is there anything fMRI is good enough at now that you think it would be reasonable to use it clinically?
That's a hard question. That's a hard question. One thing that I have heard that fMRI is being used for clinically with a lot of success at some centers is as a substitute for something called the WADA test. So I don't know if you guys know what the WADA test is, but it's if you have intractable epilepsy and you're going to have brain surgery to try to remove a part of your brain that is causing your epilepsy, it is important to figure out what parts of the brain are involved in language, because in most people it's the left. It's located on the left side of the brain, but in small proportion of people, it's located on the right side of the brain. So if they're going to go into your brain and muck about, they don't want to have you end up not being able to speak if they can help it. And so they do a test that's very invasive where they basically cut off the blood supply to one of your hemispheres and then see whether you stop talking. Okay.
So this is an alternative.
So fMRI is an alternative to that very invasive test, and has been shown that by looking at your resting patterns of communication between the left and the right hemispheres, et cetera, that you can do a very accurate job of predicting which side of the brain is involved in language. And so that is one, I think, that's already being used, and I think there's some good reasons so that even if it's not perfect, it's a lot less risky than the other alternative.
Okay, well, I think we should move on to the last scenario, which will take us a little bit outside of the clinical setting into the more public setting. And scenario four is brain regions associated with lust and love are discovered by researchers. A high-tech dating service decides to present pictures of potential matches in an fMRI machine to determine compatibility. So what did your group decide about love and lust?
Well, we questioned the validity as to, is this analysis really the best methodology for determining a match? And we universally said that none of us would participate, but we would allow it to, you know, we think that the market should allow something like this to move forward, and we wouldn't have any objection to it being available. So that said, to change our minds, it was whether or not there's a health concern. You know, it just to walk in and have an fMRI, you know, routinely done, is there any reason not to do that from a health perspective? If there were some risk, then obviously we wouldn't want to do that. Or if the equipment that's available by allowing the free market to use equipment, that maybe it takes it away from being used for better services than finding a match, then there could be some concerns there. And if it just doesn't work. But that, again, we felt that the market should be the driver as to if it doesn't work, someone, you know, they're not going to go pay to have this service done. And as far as, you know, who should have the role in deciding, with a market-driven society, we're assuming that if it doesn't work, people won't be paying for this service, and you know that they would just stop and they would go out of business as a result. But we, you know, felt that it's a viable entity and should be allowed.
Okay, so that's an interesting distinction. So when we're talking about clinical, people tend to worry a lot about whether it works or not. But in this situation, maybe market-driven forces should be enough, and that will. Maybe that'll sort out. The P less than 0.05 is no longer relevant. As long as people feel like they're getting a good match, then they'll go for this.
Yeah, I think that's good. Just to answer the question about sort of the risks, the health risks to fMRI, the main risk to fMRI is if there you have any metal in your body. So you have to have very careful screening because it can't. If you have metal in your soft tissue or if you have a pacemaker, you're not eligible to be an MRI. So there's a safety risk from that standpoint. But so far, after 30 years of MRI research, we haven't seen any long-term effects of being in the MRI magnet, which is good because I've been in there a lot. So far nothing bad has happened. But I think this also brings up the question, though, about the market in terms of healthcare. So there are people, people in San Diego who are offering the service of doing brain scans to guide your treatment for psychiatric and other kinds of disorders. And people pay for that. And so I think they think that it worked. I'm skeptical because of all the things that we've said before about whether, you know, looking at a brain scan can really, you know, help determine right now what your treatment should be for a mental disorder. But there are very well-known people in San Diego that are offering this service and plenty of people that are paying for it. So,
it's a reminder that, I mean, I've read recently a number of different things talking about how we assume that certain people are very knowledgeable in certain ways and that the experts are the ones that we want to turn to for economics, for example, to know what stocks you should invest in and so on. And it turns out that often in terms of predicting what's going to happen to the market, the less knowledgeable you are, the better you do. And there's a lot of scenarios in which actually lack of expertise and collective wisdom from people who know very little about it can turn out as a group to be useful. That doesn't mean individually they're very good at it, but as a group, on average, people often come up with some good answers. But this then comes back to the question of whether, just because something works, whether we want to trust it as being a valid result. So this has been fabulous. And I mean, the sort of the final question we asked each of your groups to consider was whose roles and responsibilities should come into play here. A number of you kind of felt you didn't get, we didn't have time to get to that question or had only a very few ideas. But I had made my own provisional list, which I think is worth thinking about in conclusion. That is that there's, of course, a role for scientists who are doing the work and to think about what does their work mean and their professional organizations. There are the journals who should decide what does it take to publish something. Should they be publishing things, for example, that haven't done any correction for multiple comparisons? Institutions of various kinds, whether they're universities or research institutes or other groups, the funders of research, the government, journalists, and the general public. And at least from my perspective, I think the answer to this question is very easy. It needs to be all of those groups. And this is not something for somebody else to figure out. Every one of these questions, as you can see, has its own nuance about what we would worry about, whether we want police officers to be checked for possible racial profiling, or whether we want to allow the free market to control certain kinds of decisions. And all of those require, I think, a concerted interest on all of our parts. I want to thank all of you for your really interesting participation tonight, and I especially want to thank Lisa for a really interesting presentation.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.